This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As kids brace themselves for another year of school, some 25 states are embroiled in lawsuits over how to pay for public education. Of course, disputes about school budgets are nothing new. Every district wants more money. Poorer districts have long argued that they need as much per student as wealthier districts, and sometimes more. For many years, lawsuits brought on the basis of equal education generally failed. Now, a new round of lawsuits is based on a different idea, not parity with richer districts, but enough money to realize the educational promises written into many state constitutions. And this argument for adequate resources is often accompanied by rafts of statistics generated by the federal No Child Left Behind law. The metrics designed to identify failing schools are being used to prove that some schools lack the funds they need to meet the law's standards. This hour on Talk of the Nation, we'll take a look at this latest twist in the ongoing struggle over how to pay for public schools. We'll take a look at how states are responding and whether more money automatically translates into better schools. Later in the program, the fight over rights to stream Olympics coverage on the Internet, and we'll find out how friends and fans of Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps are following his fortunes in Athens. But first, the fight for an adequate education. If your state is involved in a funding battle or if disputes over education funding affects schools in your area, give us a call. We'd like to hear from parents, administrators, and teachers. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now from the studios of KUVO in Denver, Colorado, is Steve Smith, Senior Education Policy Specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is a bipartisan organization. It tracks policies in all 50 states. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Explain to us, if you will, why there are so many of these cases prevalent now.
Well, I think as standards-based reform continues to be the focal point of improving schools across our country, and as the stakes continue to get higher for performance, the issue of whether there's sufficient capacity within the education systems becomes a paramount issue. And it's only fair, I think implicit within standards-based reform would be that if you're going to hold people accountable, it's only fair that they be provided with sufficient resources to meet the standards.
Mm-hmm. Who are the players in these disputes?
They're often school districts. They can also be teachers' unions operating through school districts. It could be individual parents or groups of parents bringing suit.
Give us a little bit of history. I guess everybody remembers the anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision dating back 50 years now. Describe, if you would, in layman's terms, how the fight over education funding has been waged, since then, how this fight has evolved.
Well, over the last 50 years, the courts have played a substantial role in shaping education policy. And as you mentioned, after the Brown versus Board of Education system and the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s, what's interesting is plaintiffs first brought suit on adequacy grounds. But these cases were dismissed due to what the justices termed a lack of judicially manageable standards.
When you say adequacy, this was on grounds in state constitutions that promised everybody a good education.
At first, they didn't attempt to attack the state constitutional language. In the late 60s, these cases were first brought in the federal courts, hoping to build off of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education. But the justices dismissed these cases due to a lack of judicially manageable standards or criteria or benchmarks upon which they could anchor their decisions. And
so
due to this,
that means
I'm
just trying to clarify. That means the judge is saying, we don't have the facts. We don't know.
Right. Adequacy was too subjective of a notion, is one way of looking at this. If you could ask 100 people what is an adequate education at that time, you may have, well, and still today, perhaps you would still have 100 different responses. And I think for a point of clarification, equity refers to the amount of money one group of students receives in a state compared to another, whereas adequacy refers to the amount of money each individual student requires in order to have a reasonable opportunity to meet educational standards.
And not always the same thing, as we will be hearing down the road. But then these fights over equity, they worked their way through the courts, and they often did not succeed.
Well, in the 1970s, they did find quite a bit of success. However, by the 1980s, they were finding much less success due to the fact that states had made modifications to their education finance formulas to make them somewhat more equitable. However, during the 1980s, there were really two forces that really influenced what I could term the modern adequacy movement. The first of which is people began to be afraid there might be an equity of poverty. A good analysis could be if you have a basketball team and all the players shoot free throws in the 40 percentile, that's an equitable team, but of course that would not be an adequate team.
Certainly inadequate, yes.
But the second larger influence, I think, during the 1980s was our country's embrace of the standards-based reform movement as a means of improving our educational systems. And building off of what had been implemented in the private sector, reformers suggested that states establish what they expected the education systems to perform or achieve, develop assessments to measure progress towards reaching those standards, and hold people accountable. And in return for holding people accountable, individual schools and districts were provided with a little bit of flexibility to meet those standards in the ways that they best see fit. Now, this is certainly a laudable goal and a good reform initiative. However, one of the unintended consequences of embracing standards-based reform from the state legislative perspective is that they created the judicially manageable standards or the criteria and benchmarks that justices could use in determining whether a state was meeting its constitutional responsibility.
In other words, they defined for the first time what an adequate education was.
That would certainly be the argument made by the plaintiffs. It's still up for debate, but what the plaintiffs will say is by your own definition of what standards or what students should be learning and by your own assessments that you've created to measure progress towards these standards, a significant number of students are still not meeting these educational goals, and therefore your education system is inadequate and unconstitutional.
And unconstitutional because many states have written into their constitutions a promise of a good or adequate education.
Exactly. Every state constitution has what they call an education clause, which calls for a thorough and efficient or uniform and appropriate educational system. In many states, it's the only constitutionally required government service that must be provided. So plaintiffs today are really focusing on the state education clauses rather than the equal protection clauses within state and federal constitutions.
And how are this round of lawsuits, how are they tending to fare?
Well, many see the Rose versus Council for Better Education case in Kentucky in 1989 as the beginning of the modern adequacy movement. And since that time, the plaintiffs have been successful in roughly two-thirds of the major education finance adequacy cases.
And that means they win, and therefore the courts tell the state, you're not giving this district over here enough money, give them more money?
It could be individual districts, or it could actually be they could actually require the state to bring up funding for all students within a state.
So it may be across the board, or it might be just an individual case. Well, we're talking about a new round of lawsuits, definitions of adequate education, and the eternal problem of funding in schools. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Ruth, who joins us from Burton, Ohio.
Hi. I was just calling to say that the Ohio schools have been sued numerous times because of the way they fund our school systems.
Mm-hmm. Which is how?
Property taxes. And the courts, our Supreme Court has said numerous times that the legislation has to figure out a different way to do it. And the legislation has just been so slow to move that another case will be brought up. But now our Supreme Court is more conservative, and they don't want to change the way we fund it. So it almost seems pointless to bring these lawsuits out if we can't get the change to come about even when we win.
Stephen Smith, Ruth is not the only person to complain that whatever the courts argue, sometimes the legislature does not move.
That can be the case. In the case of Ohio, it goes back to, I believe, 1996, in the Supreme Court case there. In response, the legislature did increase funding, but then there was some debate whether they had met the obligations of providing an adequate education. And more recently, as the caller mentioned, there's a change up in the court, and they somewhat dismissed the case, stating that it's a separation of powers issue, that the justices shouldn't be involved in dictating legislative policy.
And so, Ruth, I guess this Steve, do you know this case continues to hang fire in Ohio?
I know that the plaintiffs in Ohio recently petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to examine the case, but the Supreme Court did not, and they did not comment on as to why. That also brings about an interesting issue of whether we're going to see a shift towards cases being brought in federal courts, because for the last 30 years, state courts have been the primary vehicle for basing these decisions.
And again, if you're basing it on that promise in the state constitution, that's not going to be found in the federal constitution.
Exactly.
Right. Ruth, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you for taking it.
The Supreme Court of North Carolina ruled recently that state must do more to improve the quality of education in one of North Carolina's poorest counties. The decision has ramifications for funding across the state. Bob Spearman is an attorney who represented the school districts involved in the dispute, and he joins us now by phone from his office in Raleigh, North Carolina. Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be with you.
As we get from the generalities to the specifics, this lawsuit has been in courts in there in Carolina for 10 years now. Originally, plaintiffs claimed they deserved equal and adequate funding. How did the courts respond to those claims?
Well, what happened in our case is we filed a suit in 1994, and it first went to the state Supreme Court just on legal issues, and we said that there needed to be more equal funding and there needed to be adequate funding. And the court held against us on the equality claim, but held in our favor on the adequacy claim, and said that there ought to be a trial to determine, in effect, whether the kids were getting an adequate, good education, and that every child had a right to have an opportunity for a sound basic education. Then we had a lot of discovery, and we had two trials, and the court decided the case in the favor of our clients, in favor of, in effect, the school children in a small rural North Carolina county, Hoke County, and said that the state was not doing what it should and what it had to do in order to provide them with a decent education.
How did you and the courts, more importantly, arrive at the definition of an adequate education?
Well, in terms of the definition of an adequate education, that's laid out or referenced in our state constitution. And then in the case in 1997, when it was before the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, it defined a sound basic education. I won't try to go into all of it, but basically it's an education where school children learn what they need to learn so they can go on to further higher education or get a good job and compete in holding jobs in the around the country.
So these were standardized test scores, that sort of thing?
Well, in the subsequent trial, as Steve was talking about a little while ago, the judge very much did look to the scores of the students on these standardized tests to decide whether the kids were getting a sound basic education. And the children from this rural, relatively poor county in general were doing much less well on the test than were children nationally or children in other counties in the state. And that was one of the items the court looked to. It also looked at the fact that even people who graduated from the high school in this rather poor county were having a very, very difficult time getting jobs, and were having a difficult time getting into college, were having trouble in college when they got there, and some of them who went to community colleges still had to take remedial work in reading and math. And the court said that they had a right to a better education than that.
We're talking with Bob Spearman and with Steve Smith. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about education funding. Our guests are Bob Spearman, the attorney who represented poor counties in North Carolina's Leandro case, a suit against the state which sought and secured increased funding for public schools. He's with us from his office in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Steve Smith is also with us, senior education policy specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures, a bipartisan organization that tracks policies in all 50 states. He's with us from KUVO studios in Denver, Colorado. Of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. And just before the break, we were hearing about Bob Spearman about the Leandro case. Steve Smith, is this typical of the cases of this latest round of lawsuits?
It's typical in some ways, and in other ways it's very unique. I think one of the most unique aspects of the North Carolina case is how the justice first began to talk about the need to investigate whether additional funding was going to be required or whether the existing funding needed to be spent in a different manner. And the state tried to somewhat absolve itself from responsibility, saying that, yes, enough money is being provided, but localities are not providing it in the most appropriate way. And the court came back and said that it's the state's responsibility to ensure that these districts spend the money in the most appropriate way. After investigating the issue further, the justices came back and said, listen, it's not just an issue of how we're spending the money, but it's an issue of, or there's a need for more money.
More money, basically. Yeah. All right. Let me ask Bob Spearman, where does your case stand now? Was there more money or a shifting of money?
Well, where the case stands now is that after the trial court decision, which has now been affirmed on appeal, with some prodding from the court, one of the defendants, the State Board of Education, has proposed creating a new fund of over more than $220 million a year to aid these low-wealth, at-risk students. And the General Assembly did not pass that in the last session this summer. But shortly after the legislature adjourned, the Supreme Court decided the case unanimously in our favor. And we have very, very high hopes that the General Assembly will move forward to do what we think it should do and what the court has indicated needs to be done. In fact, after the case was decided by the Supreme Court in our favor, the state superintendent of the Board of Education said, and I'm quoting him now, he said, "I personally think we win this case by losing it, and I predict the General Assembly will put needed money into the system to help the poor schools that need it."
Bob Spearman, thanks very much.
Glad to be with you.
Bob Spearman represented poor counties in North Carolina's Leandro case, a suit filed against the state, which sought, as you heard, increased funding for public schools. And he was with us by phone from his office in Raleigh, North Carolina. Let's get another caller on the line. Michelle is with us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Hi there.
Hi.
A little bit to the south. I wonder if your guest could comment on our situation. We have 8 school districts in South Carolina in some of the more rural and very poor areas of our state with enormous levels of unemployment. We've been going through a year of presenting testimony in which these school districts are plaintiffs and are basically suing the state of South Carolina, again, on the adequacy issue. This is made even more political by the fact that we have a Republican governor, a Republican House of Representatives, and the law firm that is presenting the plaintiff's case is the law firm of our former governor and former Secretary of Education, Dick Riley. I wish it was getting more national publicity. Heck, I wish it was getting more state publicity, but I wonder if your guests could comment.
Steve Smith?
Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with the case down in South Carolina, and again, I think this is a perfect example of a state trying to identify what would be considered an appropriate foundation level. I think it's important to note that most states run their foundation or their funding formula through what they call a foundation program. And the foundation can be seen as the amount of money the state feels is appropriate to provide an adequate education. And I know down in South Carolina there's great debate whether the guaranteed funding level through the foundation program is appropriate.
In this case, foundation like base, like the foundation of a house.
Yes, in a sense. And the way of going about a foundation, they have an equalized foundation program. So let's say, for example, in my home state of Florida, the foundation level would be $5,000. What many states do is they require all school districts to levy a certain property tax rate. The difference between what that property tax rate generates and the foundation level is then provided by the state, and that's how they equalize funding. But again, it turns to the question of just because you have this funding equalized, the issue is whether the foundation level is appropriate or not.
Michelle, though, I take it from your what you were saying earlier, you're in favor of this legislation?
Well, it's a court case. It hasn't yet reached
this lawsuit, yes.
Right. If you know anything about South Carolina, you know that we have areas of enormous development, places where the tax base is such that localized property tax can generate huge amounts of money. And then we have districts in the state where still the level of inadequacy of just the buildings is so horrific that industry doesn't want to come in. People don't want to put their kids in public schools. So that baseline funding situation has not worked well for us, and we still can't figure out how to deal, and I think this is true for many states in the South, we just can't figure out how to remedy the damage that was done over 150 years of segregation, no education for many of our citizens, and then a completely inadequate education, which resulted in little economic development and perpetuated the cycle that we're now, confronting today. I thank your guest for taking a good look at it, and I'll try to follow up with what he's written about it. Thank you.
Michelle, thanks very much. We turn now to a critic of this type of litigation. Eric Honoshack is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a professor of education and economics at Stanford University. He's with us from the studios at Stanford University there in California. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I know you've argued this spike in lawsuits is detrimental to education over the long haul. How come?
Basically, these court cases and the legislation that follows is after a good purpose, and that is ensuring that all students have an adequate level of achievement. The problem with the lawsuits and the way they've played out is that as soon as everybody agrees that there are kids who aren't learning enough, the whole suit is translated into a statement about how many dollars should we spend. After a long period of experimentation with putting just more money into the current system, we found out that really doesn't work. It is not effective. We can find good ways to spend money, but often the money is not spent well.
I could put a dozen people on the line with you right now saying they'd love somebody to experiment with that in their school district.
Absolutely. Everybody would want somebody to experiment with it in their school district. But the overwhelming evidence is that simply taking the current system and putting more money into it will not lead to systematic overall gains in performance. And that's the real problem with these lawsuits. Once the issue becomes solely one of money, the legislatures around the country become completely balled up. Look only to New York State, which just passed a budget but can't really deal with the funding suit that they're facing from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
That is happening in a whole series of other states now where everybody gets down to talking about whether it should be a few hundred dollars more or less, and nobody gets down to the real issues of how are we going to deal with these very serious achievement and performance problems that we have.
Proponents of these suits say, look at the parameters that we're getting from the No Child Left Behind law, and you're seeing that the more poorly funded schools are the ones where students don't perform as well. That would suggest that there might be a correlation between the amount of dollars you spend per student and how well the students do.
Unfortunately, the people who say that aren't really looking at the data. That is absolutely not true. We are actually spending more in most of our poor performing districts, in our urban districts in particular, we're spending more. Now, you might argue that we're not spending enough more, but the simple fact is that we are putting more money in to try to have remedial programs and other things to help these students. They aren't working in a systematic way, and that's the problem.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Jeff, and Jeff's with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
One of the concerns that I have is in the state of Michigan, in 1970, they made a law that says that the state must provide the students with everything needed to, you know, get a good education. The problem with that is when the states can't afford to supply things as basic as pens and pencils, which was unheard of when I went to school, our parents went and took a school shopping for that. But now the teachers have to carry that burden, because if the state or the school district doesn't have that money, then to keep within the letter of the law, the teachers have to go out, purchase these items on their own with their own money to provide them to the students who, you know, typically, and I don't mean to sound bad, but typically, you know, if they need a pencil and you give them a pencil, at the end of the day, the pencil's in 14 pieces, and then the next day they need yet another pencil because they don't respect that you're giving them this. And that's, you know, so I think that the problem lies in a little bit of parental responsibility, as far as the states could probably afford more remedial programs or more true education programs if they didn't have to spend things on menial, you know, loose leaf paper or pencils.
Well, as the world land speed record holder for loss of pencils and pens, I might add, I'll turn to see if we get a response for that for Eric Honoshek.
Well, I think that there are a lot of issues about how we spend our money, but frankly, the real issues aren't pens and pencils. The real issues are getting really high-quality teachers in all the classrooms, and that's where I think we would see some real gains if we could, in fact, improve the quality of our teaching.
As you know, let me just thank Jeff for his phone call. And as you know, some of the proponents of this litigation say if you give these poor districts some bonus money that they could afford to pay teachers to retain them in their districts, they wouldn't leave for higher-paying jobs elsewhere.
Well, there's an economic principle that I would suggest, and that is that bad teachers like more money as much as good teachers. And the problem is that we insist on paying everybody according to the single salary schedule, regardless of whether they're doing a good job in the classroom or not. If we raise the salaries of all teachers, we'll get a slightly better pool of people coming in. But if we don't make decisions about who's doing well in the classrooms, and if we refuse to do that, we have little hope of, in fact, improving our performance.
I just wanted to bring Steve Smith back into the conversation. I know you've been listening as Mr. Hunter, Professor Honoshek has been talking. He says data does not bear out the argument that more money automatically transfers into better education. From the statistics you see, is that right?
I think that is a correct statement, in the sense of more money in and of itself will not improve education. It comes down to how you're going to spend that money, in addition to a more thorough examination of how we're spending current resources. And to build off of what Eric was saying as far as the need for good teachers, which is a vital component of a good education system, the collective bargaining agreements that the teachers unions often engage in with districts allow the most senior teachers to move out of the worst performing schools. And the result is that in the worst performing schools, we have the highest percentage of new teachers, the highest percentage of turnover. And I think this is an issue that can be addressed perhaps through some of the collective bargaining agreements, but also through teachers themselves and saying that, listen, I'm a more experienced teacher. I need to stick it out in this harder to serve school rather than taking my seniority and moving to an easier to serve school.
A subject we'll return to as the school year gets ever and ever closer. It's already arrived some places. Eric Honoshek, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Eric Honoshek, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, a professor of education and economics at Stanford University, joined us from Stanford, California. And we'd also like to thank Steve Smith, senior education policy specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures. And he joined us from the studios of KUVO in Denver, Colorado. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. Oh, thank you, Steve. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.